Welcome to the Toastmasters Podcast, the official podcast of Toastmasters International. Hello, everybody. This is Greg Gazin. Toastmasters International holds its annual convention every August. This year's event will take place from August 20th to 23rd in the city of Brotherly Love, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, USA. Each year here at the Toastmasters Podcast, we have the honor and delight of speaking with the opening keynote speaker for the International Convention, the individual who'll be officially kicking off the event. And she is Anne Bonny, and she was born to talk. Just ask any of her childhood teachers who wrote "talks too much" on her report cards. Now she's turned that chatter into a powerhouse career, jet-setting around the globe to help overwhelmed professionals build resilience in the discomfort of change. Anne is a CSP, Certified Speaking Professional, a dynamic keynote speaker, energizing conference MC, two-time author, and the host of the hit podcast, Dancing in the Discomfort Zone. Anne lights up both virtual and in-person stages with her high-energy, relatable style. After 2 decades of crushing it in the corporate and nonprofit leadership positions, she now lights up stages around the globe, helping teams and leaders embrace change, boost resilience, conquer tough conversations, and lead with emotional intelligence. Anne is also a former Toastmaster who will be lighting up the stage live and live streamed with her keynote presentation, Ignite Your Next Move, Courageously Dancing into the Future. And that'll be happening Wednesday, August 20th at 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time or Coordinated Universal Time minus 4. Anne's profile by Stephanie Darling, Dance into the Future with Anne Bonny, keynote speaker for the 2025 International Convention, Encourages Embraces Change, is featured in the April 2025 issue of the Toastmaster magazine. Coming to us today from St. Petersburg, Florida, Anne Bonny, welcome to the Toastmasters podcast.
Hey, Greg, thank you. It's good to be here.
I read your profile. I watched your TEDx talk. It's pretty exciting. I'm certainly looking forward to your keynote, but we want to get to know you a little bit better today. And so to kick things off, again, I read your profile, watched your TED talk, watched other videos. And as much as it sounds cliche, one of the constant themes here is change. And having been someone who is used to change in her life and as a change management professional, we see change happening every day. Why is it still so hard for most people?
Yeah, our brains are not built to deal well with change. We like our habits. We like our, you know, our knowns. And our brain is created to have a stress response when something is new, when something's unfamiliar, when something changes, because we don't know how to respond to it. We have to figure it out. And A, our brain is lazy and doesn't want to have to do that work because it wants to save the energy for when there's a survival situation. But B, the unfamiliar could be dangerous to your brain. Okay, now your brain, we're working with old hardware here. It hasn't gotten the software upgrade to the modern times. It doesn't quite realize that the stress of, you know, a change in the computer system at work is not a life-threatening situation. That's why we have this resistance. So for those people who aren't totally all about change, it means your brain is working right.
Now, of course, we say our brain doesn't fully mature until probably late in our teens. And you became aware of the discomfort of change and specifically mentioned in the article at the age of 8, and that you actually welcome change as this lifelong growth opportunity and not a place to be feared or to be trapped in. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that's after 50 years and a lot of personal reflection and perhaps a little bit of therapy. But, you know, I've always been, you know, the kid that just sort of charges into it. I've been called a bulldozer, a bull in a china shop. You call it what you will. But yeah, when I was 8 or 7, my brother and I got home from school and my parents said, "We're moving to Saudi Arabia," which from Lake of the Ozarks, Missouri in the United States was a little bit of a shift. Completely new culture, completely new environment. You know, we were moving to the desert and just completely new, didn't know the language, didn't have any friends, all the things. So we lived in Saudi for 2 years. We lived in Egypt for a year. We lived in Greece for 4 years. And so going through all of those changes just kind of made it comfortable kind of to me.
So you felt comfortable with the change, and that continued on, of course, in your work career. You share in the article that you've had so many different careers. Could you tell us about a few of those?
Yeah, sure. I thought I wanted to be a vet when I was a little kid. And then I shadowed a vet and I was like, oh, that was terrible. All the animals are sick and scared. I was like, that's okay. I'll just be a Broadway star. So I went to a performing arts school. And then at my senior year, I said, well, I don't think I want that life. I'm going to become a teacher. So I became a special ed teacher. And after 2 years, one spring break, we went down to San Antonio, Texas to SeaWorld, and I saw the killer whale show and the sea lion show. And I was like, oh my gosh, when I was a little kid and I said I wanted to be a vet, I actually wanted that job. I wanted to be an animal trainer. So when I got back from vacation, I started looking into what I needed to become an animal trainer. And it turns out the psychology and learning theory education that I'd gotten to become a teacher was what I needed. Like, we had biologists to deal with the water quality and all that. We had vets to deal with the health of the animals. I was just there to teach them stuff. So after about 8 months of volunteering, I got hired as a trainer of seals and sea lions. Then we moved to Arizona where there's no water. So my sea lion career was over, but I got to work with birds of prey and train birds of prey, which was an amazing job and incredible leadership lessons from that. Then I decided I needed a big kid job. I was getting a divorce and decided, oh, well, I better pay a little bit more attention to, you know, opportunity and 401k and all that. I had moved to Baltimore, Maryland, and ended up working for Under Armour for about 10 years from 2002. And it was just an incredible journey to grow with that company. Then I worked for another company called Les Mills out of New Zealand, which was a really exciting opportunity to work for a huge global company. Yeah, that was really cool. Then I worked for a large gym chain in New York City, running their entire group exercise program. About 10 years ago from now, I said, well, this big kid job is for the birds. I'm going to go move into my parents' basement and see if I can start a career as a professional speaker. And so that's when I got introduced to Toastmasters and got that thing rolling. That's been 10 years. I feel like I'm just getting started.
Wow. It almost seems, just to sort of take the other side for a moment, it almost sounds like the grass is greener on the other side of the fence syndrome. Is it not?
I keep jumping to the other yards. But you know what? I've found that the grass isn't greener. The grass just tastes different. Because of the way I grew up moving a lot, I have become unafraid of changing things. And it's not a life that a lot of people would jump onto. That, you know, a lot of people like a little bit more stability, and that's perfectly acceptable. It's just sort of the way that my life has developed. And I think it's been green grass all around.
That's awesome. In hindsight, it's also a great way to gain all kinds of transferable skills. I'm sure everything that you've done can be transferred into a different field.
Well, and you're totally right. I mean, this is something that as I do high school talks with kids, it's like, hey, look at my career path. You may not have a crazy winding career path like this, but I have learned things along the way and every single one of the jobs and every transition, every move that have helped me be successful now. So none of it's wasted, all that experience, as long as we get out of the basement.
That makes sense. I mean, I've known growing up, there were some kids in our class that they knew exactly what they wanted to do. But I know that many of us wrestled with the decision. And I love in the article that you had mentioned that when wrestling with a decision and if you had doubts about a decision, give it some sassy back talk. What does that do and what does that look like?
When your brain is having that stress response that we talked about a little earlier, when something is unfamiliar and that voice of doubt in your head is telling you all the things that could go wrong, all the reasons you're not good at this, all the reasons that you're not going to get the support you need, that's where the sassy backtalk is, because that's that protective part of your brain trying to get you back to quote unquote safety. When I say engage in some sassy backtalk, engage that logical part of your brain, because the voice of doubt comes from that protective part. But if we bring in the logical part and say, okay, wait a minute, yes, all those things could go wrong, and thank you, brain, for trying to keep me alive. And what if this goes right? And how likely are those bad things to happen? And is there anything I can do to mitigate the challenge? That's the sassy backtalk with that voice of doubt to bring a little bit more perspective. Another great question to have that, you know, in that sassy backtalk conversation is, hey, wait a minute. Think about all the things that I've overcome, that I've figured out, and that I've rescued from the brink of disaster, as it were, if your life is anything like mine. You know, how many times have I brought this back and been able to pull it together, even if it did go wrong? So that's where the sassy backtalk comes in. It's just bringing in the logic and saying yes and to your voice of doubt.
Is that where you refer to how it helps you build this mental toughness that you speak about?
Mental toughness is a much broader piece, but managing your self-talk is a big piece of that mental toughness, of being able to see that voice of doubt for what it is. A friend of mine who was recently on the podcast says, just because this is uncomfortable doesn't mean it's going to go badly. And I think that's a really important thing, especially when we're embracing change, when we're embracing innovation. It's important to remember that just because this is uncomfortable doesn't mean it's going to go badly.
Right. I like in the article you mentioned, hey, brain, I've got this. And it reminds me of years ago where I learned to acknowledge that the butterflies are there, not try to fight them or beat them out of your stomach, but to make sure that you say, hey, you're here. It's fine. We're going to have fun together.
Well, and that's why I call it dancing in the discomfort zone, because it's like, we know it's uncomfortable. It's not going to not be uncomfortable. Don't wait for it to be comfortable. It's going to be uncomfortable. And here we go. Come on, brain. Let's get on board.
Where did you come up with this dancing with discomfort? I just love the alliteration.
It started with everybody knows about the comfort zone. And so I started talking about the discomfort zone because I think embracing discomfort is an important piece of being a successful human. Then it was like, don't just be in the discomfort zone. We have to dance in it. We have to move through it and be an active participant in change, because otherwise, you know, we swirl around in the anxiety of the whole thing and it's still uncomfortable. We're just not getting anywhere. And so dancing in the discomfort zone became a fun way to think about being not comfortable.
You know, what's funny, Anne, as I'm looking at my notes on the screen here, and I just realized the first five letters in the word discomfort are disco.
Disco. Oh my God, that's hilarious. And I just bought some disco ball glasses too. Oh, that's funny. I never noted that.
It just popped up. It's amazing what the brain does, isn't it?
Right. Suddenly when dancing comes into the forefront.
I'd love to talk a little bit about the mental toughness. In the article, it mentions that getting there takes grit, and it calls for intentionally seeking unknown possibilities. Can you explain a little bit about that? How does it work?
Yeah, sure. Mental toughness, you know, and it sounds like you got hit one too many times on the football field or the soccer pitch, you know?
It does. It does, yeah.
But what mental toughness is it's basically resilience plus confidence. Like, as humans, we're naturally resilient. You will bounce back. You will figure it out. That's just what humans do. But when you add confidence to that, to create that mental toughness, it's the ability to say, okay, this is going to be terrible, and I got it. You know, it's that ability to believe in your own ability to push through things. And it just makes it a little less difficult when you need to deal with unknowns, unfamiliar, innovation, change, whatever you want to call it. There are lots of different ways to build your mental toughness, but I believe a big one, and you heard my TEDx talk, is all around this, is that the more we are embracing the low stakes, uncertain situations, the better we're going to be when we're faced with uncertain situations that we can't control. So for example, I went to Africa in the December of 2021 to see if I could make it to the top of Kilimanjaro. It's not mountain climbing like Everest. It's a hard hike, but you're still at 19,000 feet. You know, it's still a significant mountain. And I didn't know whether success was going to happen. You know, there's always a chance that you're going to fail. And by embracing that challenging situation, I increased my own trust in my ability to figure things out. So right now I'm dealing with a medical thing that I'm going to have to go get fixed. There's a lot of uncertainty and all that, but I feel a little more calm because I believe in my ability to figure things out. I believe in my team that's going to help me get through this. So it's helping to build that confidence. Like, no matter what comes, we'll figure it out and it'll be okay.
Yeah, in the article you mentioned, when facing a problem, always ask yourself, how else could I solve this? And it's an interesting take because quite often people will say, oh, I got this problem. What am I going to do? I can't do this. This is too hard. And you change the narrative.
Well, yeah, because it changes the way your brain responds to the question, right? We always say, what do I do? Well, our brain wants certainty. It wants that security. And your brain's going to say, do this. We did it yesterday and it worked. But oftentimes we use yesterday's solution for today's problem and it doesn't actually solve today's problem. We miss key details. We miss, you know, because we're in such a rush to get to the, you know, what we're going to do that we miss key details. And so understanding that your brain wants to rush to certainty can allow you to take a deep breath, pause for a sec, and instead of saying, what should I do? Saying, how else could I solve this? Because then your brain goes, oh, well, we could do this like we did yesterday, or we could do this, or here's a crazy idea, or what about this? And you end up in more of a curiosity place of what are my options here versus just the panic of, I need to know what to do right now. And so I love that question. It just shifts the way your brain responds to the question.
If you have this sort of tunnel vision that if A, then B, you never know that perhaps C or D might actually be a better answer.
Absolutely. And that's why I love how much I got to travel and how much I got to see the world and different cultures and different ways of doing things. And because it ingrained in me that my way is not the only way. And I think that's one of the huge things that I talk about in emotional intelligence workshops and talks and things like that, is there's as many ways of doing life as there are people. And the more we can be open-minded to other people's ways of doing things, other people's ideas, the less miserable life's going to be.
That reminds me when I was in school years ago and they talked about how you can take something and make something else. It was the Cow Brand baking soda. They discovered that baking soda can not only be used for cooking, but it could be used for deodorizing. It could be used for all different types of things and flushing out sinks and things like that. But
it's also really fun to tactile. I used to work with kids with autism and we do a lot of tactile stuff. And it's cool if you put it in water, let it settle and then run your fingers through it. It's a really cool tactile experience.
Yeah. I look back at some of the things that you've done and the things that you've overcome, and you share with your audiences the power of action over fear and doubts. It's obvious from our conversation and also from what I've researched is that you are very confident. What I'm wondering is, what scares you?
Wow, you're going deep on this, Greg. The fear of being helpless is a big one. And again, as I said, I'm going into a medical situation and a surgery, and a friend of mine is coming down to help, and just the thought of needing her help to kind of do things for the few days is very uncomfortable for me, but that's a short-term situation. I think one of the biggest things that scares me is be ending up in that situation, and I'm sure I would be fine and resilient and yada yada, but the thought of not being able to move myself around in the world and being alone in that is, that's pretty terrifying.
Well, I like to ask those kinds of questions because sometimes you meet people like yourself who are like, wow, I mean, there's no way I can do half the things that you've done. And so I can't be like you.
It's nice to know that something scares you.
What I'm thinking is it's more along the lines how someone looks up to someone that they admire and they go, well, I can never do that. That's all. It's kind of like watching a famous hockey player or an actor doing something that's like, wow, they're invincible. But yet you're human too, right?
Well, totally. And the thing about it is so often, and this is what I talk about when I talk about the action part and punch it, Margaret, which is my trademarked phrase, having the courage to just do the thing, to just make the commitment. And just, you know, plunk the money down or put it, the more we do these things. And sometimes it might just be, I'm going to go to a pottery class and I've never done pottery before. Or I'm going to go to this weird street market, you know, with quilting and I don't know anything about that. Just putting ourselves in these little low stakes, unfamiliar situations boosts that confidence and boosts that ability to do the next thing and to do the next thing, you know? I didn't come out of the womb and go up Kilimanjaro. There was a lot leading up to that.
Wow.
So I wouldn't be surprised if my mom had climbed Kilimanjaro pregnant.
Can you think of a time that you didn't have the words to tell your brain, I got this, and what you did about it?
I was in New York City. I was on a temporary assignment with Les Mills to launch a bunch of our programs with the clubs in New York City. And my special project was ending, and they didn't have a job. They had reorganized the whole company, and they didn't have a job for me back at Les Mills. And I was freaking out because I didn't want to leave the company. I loved the mission. I loved the people. It was amazing. But the options that were being offered to me weren't, they were a step down, and I wasn't willing to do that. But I was freaking out and couldn't see like an option. And, you know, this is part of mental toughness too, is the social connection. I spent more time on the phone with my poor brother freaking out. Like, what am I going to do? Oh my God. And he's just trying to calm me down. Eventually he said, well, what are your other options? And again, this goes back to the question of how else could I solve this? I was so single focused on getting back to Les Mills that I didn't even open the door and look at what else there was. And it was somebody else saying, my brother saying, hey, what, you have other options here. Les Mills is not the only option. That is the biggest piece, is sometimes we need an outside perspective. Sometimes we need an outside cheerleader. Sometimes we need somebody else to point out the obvious, you know, like, hey, this, you know, kind of obvious here. That's the biggest piece, I think, for me, when I'm spinning in my own fear and doubt and all that, is to get somebody else to weigh in. And you got to be careful of who you invite to weigh in. But my brother's always been a perfect sounding board for that kind of thing. So worked out really well.
I guess you got to be careful who your substitute teacher is.
It's so true, right? I mean, because you're not going to ask your friend who is significantly change and risk averse about a big life change. Maybe you ask them, but you also ask somebody else. You know, you want to get a nicely well-rounded perspective.
Yeah, well, you might be surprised what you hear from them. You might assume that they might say, oh, they're going to take the safe route. But they might say, well, you know what? If I, you know, if possibilities were endless, I might do this.
Yeah. And those are conversations I call circular conversations. Like, hey, I'm not trying to solve something immediately here. Let's just roll around in some of these ideas and just kind of throw pros and cons back and forth and just kind of talk in a circle for a little bit, because so often that clarifies things in your mind. Yeah, just talking it out.
Yeah. I had a manager many, many, many years ago, and I remember he had given me a task to do and I could not figure out how to do it. So I went back to him looking for some guidance, and he wasn't going to let me go easily. So he said to me, I said, I couldn't do it. He says, I know you can't, but if you could, what would you do? And he kept repeating that question over and over and over till I finally actually said something. He said, there you go. Start from there.
Do that. Yeah.
And you mentioned joining Toastmasters in the article. It says you joined back in 2013, which wasn't really that long ago compared to the length of your career. I'm just curious how you stumbled across Toastmasters.
Yeah, my dad was a Toastmaster back when I was in college. And so I was familiar with it. And then when I was in New York City and I was deciding that big kid jobs were not my area anymore, I was considering being a professional speaker. And I thought, well, Toastmasters is a perfect place to start. You know, let me get up, get some experience, meet some people, you know, have some safe, low stakes speaking opportunities if I'm going to make this a professional thing. And it ended up being great. I joined a group in New York City down in the Wall Street group, and they were lovely. And just, it's just always so welcoming and makes this thing that's scary to most people into something that's really positive. And again, you're bringing that social connection in, which is part of mental toughness. But yeah, that was kind of how it all started.
Yeah. And there, it's a great place to get feedback, not necessarily sassy back talk, but you will get feedback.
Sometimes people are pretty sassy when they're pointing out your ums and your so's.
Yeah, that's true. Not the Toastmasters way. This has been absolutely awesome. I want to touch upon another point, and it's so ironic. And I'll tell you after you answer the question, how it relates back to just our previous episode in the Toastmasters podcast. In the article, and I love this, you say, pause in the discomfort of uncertainty just long enough to consider multiple options. Now, you touched a little bit upon that earlier, but can you just enlighten us a little bit more about it?
Well, yeah. I mean, it goes right back to that question of how else can I solve this? And the understanding that your brain wants to jump to certainty. So if we pause in that discomfort of like, my brain wants to get me to certainty and security of knowing, but I really want to make sure that I've got the right answer for today's problem right now. And so we have to kind of pause our brain's desire to go to that certainty and get curious. And that's where that all comes from, is that whole, you know, make sure that you're not just going on habit. And this is exactly what my keynote's going to be about on the 20th of August in Philly, is, you know, Toastmasters has been doing amazing things for people for 100 years. And as you start your next 100 years, you might have to do things differently because the world is just plain different. And so having the courage to say, let's try a new way. Let's try something different than we did yesterday. It's going to be uncomfortable because we don't know how it's going to go because we haven't done it before. And that's how we innovate and solve for today's problem or for tomorrow's problem, rather than just going on what's comfortable and what's habit.
Well, that's awesome. That was going to be my question after this next one.
I ruined it for you.
No, I got the sassy back talk a little earlier than I anticipated, I guess.
That's what you get from the redhead. What can I say?
You know how sometimes, like, if you buy a new car or a new used car, all of a sudden you see that same car everywhere? It's the same thing with this particular topic. In our last episode on the Toastmasters podcast, we interviewed a former pilot who's currently a pilot instructor and a Toastmaster. His name was Phil Wilkes. We were talking about how lessons from the aviation world can fit into everyday life. And he was sharing with me a story. We were talking about reactions and we were talking about decision-making. And in one of the episodes of one of his podcasts, he had talked about how the autopilot had disengaged in a plane and the knee-jerk reaction by the crew unfortunately resulted in some deaths. He was trying to reinforce is that you need to respond rather than react. We were also talking about, if you recall, Sully Sullenberger, Miracle on the Hudson, Airways Flight 1459, where the birds had got into the engine. He had to make some decisions and he had to land the plane on the Hudson. One of the things that Phil had said to me, he says, and I actually wrote down this quote because I wanted to make sure that I had it right. He said, I think the one thing I've learned over 35 years as a professional aviator is that there's almost zero circumstances under which there's not time to undergo some form of a decision-making process. Mm-hmm. And that just tied into what you said, and it really, really reinforced it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's such an important piece of getting the decisions right. Even though we may be choosing a more uncomfortable decision, we're choosing it for today, which I think is super important.
Because you talk about ankle deep in dilemma, but I think he was neck deep in dilemma at that point.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
As children, we're always taught to challenge ourselves to raise the bar. But you say that it's okay to lower expectations when they don't go exactly as planned. Why is that?
You know, it's not so much to lower them when things don't go as planned. It's to lower them in preparation for the unknown. Really, it's expect things to be difficult, expect things to not go exactly as you thought. Because if that's the expectation, you know, and I'm not saying lower your expectation of other people. I'm not saying don't be optimistic, but be realistic about what could happen. We so often are surprised when things change and surprised when things don't go exactly the way we thought they were going to go. And rarely do they stay the same or go the way we thought they were going to go. And so by lowering your expectations and saying, well, this could go well, and we could bump into some challenges. By lowering that expectation and being realistic about it, it allows you to not be as surprised when things don't go perfectly. And so instead of being super disappointed that things didn't go perfectly, you're saying, okay, cool. I kind of expected this. Or if it does go perfectly, you're like, holy cow, this is the best day ever. You know, it's just a way to bring a realistic expectation into life so that you're not constantly disappointed by reality.
That makes sense. And if you have some sort of success, then you feel satisfied that you can move forward. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. And learn from it. And thus it makes it a success. You know, we have such a concrete view of failure. Bottom line is you just keep moving and keep learning and you keep winning. Maybe. Hopefully. No, I haven't won them all. That's for sure. But I feel like the more you do and the more you try, even when things don't go well, it strengthens that trust in yourself to be able to figure things out. You know, I mean, you start to believe, okay, yeah, things haven't always gone great. And here I am. We build that trust in our own ability.
I'm just about looking forward to the next time I mess up something.
Right? You're welcome.
This has been absolutely wonderful, Anne. And folks, if you loved learning about Anne's sassy back talk, et cetera, and found this episode valuable, I encourage you to share it with your friends and family and fellow Toastmasters. You can find the Toastmasters podcast at toastmasterspodcast.com, Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts, including YouTube podcasts. And as we wrap up, I know that everyone is different, but can you offer us perhaps one piece of sassy advice that most people could perhaps help them dance with a little bit of their discomfort?
If it was one big piece, it would be don't do it alone. So often, especially when we're uncomfortable, when we're uncertain, we isolate because we don't want to bring anybody down. We don't want to lean on anybody. But that social connection is such a huge piece of getting through life and getting through change and getting through challenges and getting through change that we pick that's good but still hard is don't do it alone. Make sure you got somebody there with you. Yeah.
Well, that's certainly some sage advice. And finally, where can people find out more about Anne Bonny?
Well, yourchangespeaker.com is my website. You can find everything from there. Anne Bonny was an infamous female pirate. So if you Google Anne Bonny, you'll get a lot of history about a pirate. But if you put in speaker Anne Bonny, you'll find the little redhead.
Awesome. And we'll certainly put that into the program show notes. And of course, a reminder that Anne's keynote presentation, Ignite Your Next Move, Courageously Dancing into the Future, Wednesday, August 20th, 9 p.m. Eastern. You'll be able to check that out live if you attend the conference, which we encourage you to do. Or if you can't be there, you could be there virtually live stream. And also Anne's profile by Stephanie Darling, Dance into the Future with Anne Bonny, that you can find in the April 2025 issue of the Toastmaster magazine. Anne Bonny, thank you so much for your sassy talk back. No, back talk? No. It's been an absolute honor and a pleasure. And thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
It's been awesome, Greg. Thanks. And I look forward to seeing you all in Philadelphia in August.